Yes, Tina?
One thing that impressed me was that in each chapter they talked about how the influence of technology is coming in and that they have to deal with that. The Muslim women are being more exposed to human rights and being more exposed to, that they don't necessarily have to read it because they can hear about it and they can see it a lot more with the influence coming into their cultures. Mm-hmm. And that there's not a home that no longer is or can no longer be closeted, that the influence is coming in even no matter how hard they try to keep it out, that they're still getting influenced by it.
Yes, yes. Yeah, this is a kind of technological revolution that will affect every part of the Muslim world, even Saudi Arabia. In fact, Saudi Arabia is well equipped with money and technology, and in the far distant places, people will hear and women will hear. I remember a Pakistani nurse who was working in Saudi Arabia and talking to one of her patients in the hospital, in the public hospital, government hospital, and this Saudi woman thought that anybody coming from Pakistan would be Muslim, but she actually, it was a shock to her to find out that this nurse was not a Muslim, because she had at that time, and that would have been 20 years ago, had never heard of anybody not being a Muslim. She'd never heard that there was anything else in the world. And that is... this nurse told her that she was a follower. She worshipped the one God and followed the Lord Jesus Christ and so on. So she explained. But this was unlikely to happen, except perhaps in some Bedouin camp. But I doubt if it's happening there, because they will have some radio or something. So this is a revolution, a technology revolution, which is affecting the whole world. Anything else that you noticed, Tina?
That was the main thing,
was it? Right. Yes, Doreen?
They don't have the will anymore to keep the family together. And that is going to make a big change for women, because women have always been kind of the hub that held the family intact. And because in this day and age where women do find out that they can work, they can drive a car.
Yes.
In Turkey, especially Iran,
yes.
Women drive cars and so on. Mm. And they're finding that having more freedom has sort of scattered the nuclear family. And they just don't seem to put the emphasis today on my grandmother and my aunt, my older aunt, and so on. Although they might take them in, preservation of this close-knit family,
yes,
is... I noticed this especially when we were in Turkey, that it certainly has an effect on women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. And in the modern world of today, so many people move, refugees, there are Afghans in many parts of the world, there wouldn't have been previously. And if you think of, I can think of Afghan families where one member of the family is in Russia, another member of the family is in Germany, another is in Afghanistan, and another is in Pakistan, and perhaps two of the same siblings are dead because of the war, of the wars. But that family will have great difficulty in ever reassembling as an extended family. If you think of... you can think of tremendous shifts in population. Every kind of disturbed situation, we're looking at Kosovo these days, the province, the Pristina, the province in which I think 90% are Albanians. But and they have very little freedom. They have limited freedom compared with what they had even a few years ago. But because of the situation there, some of them are moving to Albania itself. But it's an uprooting, and there will be, unless something really is negotiated, there will be another piece of turmoil. But this happens in so many parts of the world, as we know. But in this, you can think of the many Muslims who are affected, Muslim women, and uprooting. And this, I once met an elderly woman. She was a refugee. I went to a city of Pakistan to meet the people from Uzbekistan and Turkestan, I think it was, who had come as refugees to Pakistan. They came to one particular city. They kept together. And so there were several thousand in this small city. And so I talked to this elderly Muslim woman, and she told me, well, I've been thrice in my life I've been a refugee. I came with my parents to Afghanistan from somewhere else, Uzbekistan, I think. And I came and I lived in Afghanistan for many years, and now I have come here, and I'm a refugee. So as a child, she was a refugee. As a grandmother, she was a refugee. Wonderfully, her son came to faith in Christ, and I was able to talk to her about being a pilgrim. But I was very moved to think that twice in a lifetime she's uprooted from her country. She made Afghanistan her home, and there are some Uzbeks there, but Pakistan is another major shift for her, and I don't know how she can make it her home, but maybe. So I told her of the city which is above. I told her my father's house there are many mansions, and so on. There are many. That's a very good sort of opportunity to share. But her son was studying the Gospel of John. He was a doctor, and he had come to faith. Any other matter that you that struck you as you read any of these, let's say these three chapters that you've read?
I just have one more.
Yes, please.
I was just thinking that later on in the chapter where it talked about the women being fearful of the breakdown of the traditional home, like you said, and them having to go out to work and not feel as confident in their husbands as they used to, and in providing for their families, and then how the shift begins to, there has begun a shift of responsibility for the family when the woman has to go out to work and she starts making the profit when the husband's not making the profit. And so even though she has a stronger voice in the family, that the woman would rather still be under the husband, but if the husband is not fulfilling his responsibility, she begins to take steps into fulfilling that responsibility by going out into the workforce and getting a job. So I thought that was interesting.
Yes, very interesting. Mm. Yeah, we see this a lot in Egypt particularly. See it in many Muslim countries, yes. And it's certainly a fairly new idea. Yes, Jay?
Well, I think all of this is going to put us missionaries in some difficult and sensitive situations as we're reaching out to Muslim families. Similar to the experiences we've had in France, for example, between the generational differences, the traditional mom and dad, their approach to life, their understanding of modesty, and their sons and daughters, particularly the daughters, growing up in a Western society and enjoying in that conflict of how that daughter should live. And it puts us in the middle of those type of tensions and dynamics at times. And I'm sure that as the world becomes more of a unity and globalization of the world economy, the influences of values and so forth, we're going to see the same things in the Middle East and in other traditional Muslim countries.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's right. Thank you. I've noticed among Bengalis or among Bangladeshis and Pakistanis who settle in Britain, that the second and third generation have a problem because they're relating to the traditional culture which their parents are trying to preserve. They're relating to the youth culture in the country in which they are, and they're sort of caught in this. But I have been suggesting to churches in Britain that perhaps what is needed is a new type of youth worker, because the average kind of youth worker in a church or somebody in charge of youth work is not always familiar with the almost three world views that the young person is coping with, or the terrific tensions that can be created because of mixing with the local majority youth, and then the conservative pressure from parents. And so you have a very mixed scene, which is very confusing probably to somebody who's 13 or 14 or 15. How do you preserve the traditional framework of life in a minority situation? And often we need to think about Muslims and Muslim women living out their lives in majority situation where the majority is Muslim. The majority, if you live in Indonesia, the majority is Muslim. But if you live in Europe, the minority is Muslim, and except in Albania. And there are many issues that have to be worked out that way. Now, anything anyone else would like to say, particularly about challenges for Muslim women in a postmodern world? Otherwise, I would look at the next chapter, but... maybe we've got the chapters the wrong way around, but it doesn't matter. No, they're not. Anything you'd like to say further? I'd like us to consider this next chapter, Women and the Veil, Personal Responses to Global Process. Anybody got some comments here as you've read this chapter? Women and the Veil, Personal Responses to Global Process. I can't remember if it's in this chapter, but in thinking about women and the veil and about the present day, personal responses in the present day, there is a new approach to the veil by quite a number of Muslim women. Some who didn't wear it before are choosing to wear it as a sign of their identity. So you will find a very fashionable and modern Muslim woman in Lahore who didn't wear the veil, perhaps wearing it. Or you'll find a very fashionable Arab woman in London who didn't wear the veil, now wearing it by choice. So when you get educated women by choice wearing it, sometimes it tells us something about that they want to, they have found some identity and they want to emphasize that. This is a bit different from, say, Begum Ikramullah. She was a Pakistani woman from the upper class and quite well known, and her husband was well known. She dedicates her book. She wrote an autobiography, and she dedicated the book to my husband, who allowed me to leave aside the veil and has regretted it ever afterwards. And I think she was sort of joking, but the point is that she left it aside and was a prominent woman in Pakistani life. Now, if her daughter or somebody of the next generation deliberately takes on the veil, having grown up in a much freer society, it's a way of announcing, or it's a way of declaring identity. the identity has come, and that person has decided to go clearly in an Islamic way, but deliberately wearing the veil, just say something to the people around. And it does say something to the people around, especially where Muslims are in minority. So anything you would like to say further on women and the veil? What did you find out about personal responses to the global process? That was one of them, I believe. If you look at the section on page 146, problems of interpretation, we've got something here about quoting from Miranissi. Beyond the scriptural references to the absolute requirement of modesty, a central problem is the relationship between hijab and the social process of veiling. Commentators have debated whether the wearing of the veil is demanded as an absolute religious obligation. There is at best a questionable basis for the practice in the Quran. Debates within Islam emphasize the lack of consensus on the precise form of dress stipulated by the requirement of modest conduct. Akbar Ahmed makes the useful general point that Islam is specific about modesty in both men and women, a dress that looks best when skin tight and intended to indicate the contours of the torso violates this injunction. However, apart from the problem of distinguishing intention or motive for dress style of dress, modesty remains a complex cultural concept in that it refers both to an inner state and to a repertoire of behaviours indicative of that state. In this regard, it can be argued that the veil makes both dimensions of modesty literate. The veil, later on it says, is a status. As a further complicating factor is the observation that the veil, as a status symbol, rooted in pre-Islamic Arab traditions, is at odds with the reforming, egalitarian inspiration and ethos of Islam. Yeah, well, we are familiar with these kind of arguments, and we've perhaps read quite a lot about the veil, to veil or not to veil, may be the question. But the point is that there are those who are fundamentalist who are joining the women's equivalent of the Muslim Brotherhood. So there are those, you see more and more women veiling in Iran and some parts of the world. You have these two things going on, those who do veil and those who don't. But the reasons are not the same as today as they were. And we find very elegant and educated women wearing the veil. Jemima Imran Khan's wife, she veils. Well, this is saying something. She doesn't have to veil in the city of Lahore. She veils because she chooses to veil. And I don't think she's under any pressure to do it, but she chooses. And I'm trying to think of other outstanding people, but there are people who in no way need to veil, who choose to, because they're wanting to make this a statement about their identity. Yes, Doreen?
I don't think, though, that we should forget, we should not forget that when a country goes more Islamic, the men go more Islamic, more fundamentalist, and they insist. We had many girls who did not want to wear the veil at all, not making a statement, but their fathers and their brothers said, you must.
Yeah.
You're going outside of my house. You must wear, because of the father's reputation.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Generally, when a country becomes more fundamentalist for some reason or another, like under Khomeini in Iran or under President Zia-ul-Haq in Pakistan, the dress code changes. And I think in government offices, men were, more or less commanded to wear shalwar kameez, and they were not to wear suits and ties. And then the radio announcers changed their kind of gear as well. And we still continued under that regime to have women radio announcers as well as men, but they would have their heads covered, and they would, whereas before they didn't. And I think I told you about how after Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was turned out, the dress code in Islamabad changed, and under President Zia-ul Haq, even prayer beads matched the colours of the rest of the dress. I mean, this is that's because there's an influence being imposed. But by free choice, there are quite a number of Muslim women who do not need to wear the veil and who are not connected with fundamentalists, who choose to do so as an expression of their identity. Mainly we will see it, at least in Britain, under people of other origin, mostly those who are have been British and their families have been British through many generations, converts to Islam. So it'd be interesting to know. I haven't looked at the situation in the United States, but quite a number of people who were not Muslim and didn't grow up, who grew up here and whose grandparents grew up here and their great-grandparents grew up here, they have embraced Islam. And I think you'll find a fair good percentage of them do wear the veil. In Britain this is so. I don't know if it's true here. So that's an expression, that's a declaration, that says something. They don't have to do it, but they do it because they're making a statement. Anything else that you noticed as you read these three chapters?
And again, it just reminded me of the conflict, not only just the tensions that Muslim women face in their own countries, but because of our experience working with Muslims in Western countries, you know, those tensions are going to face us, apply to us also. I mean, in France, for example, there's a hot debate over the rights of high school girls on wearing the veil. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure as Islam grows in America, for example, companies, perhaps even the government, the military, we're going to have to face these cultural issues.
And
the whole issue of religious freedom and what extent do we have as rights to dress in such and such manner.
Yes. I just thought of an individual example, and I can't remember if it refers to Kuwait or to Jordan. I think to Jordan, in a medical school there, where one of the students turned up for an autopsy to part of the medical training with her head covered, and there was quite a row about it because it's probably not the best gear to do some of your medical training. But there was almost a riot on this issue. But anyway, that's just a small point, perhaps. Any other thought? Well, I hope that you will at least buy one of these books which deals with the issues of gender, or these dozens of books which are coming out about Muslim women. And generally, they're compendiums. They're generally 10 different chapters on different parts of the world. The other thing you can do is when you go to a library to use its reference section, have a look and see what's out. Look through the list of contents and see what's on your country, and then just photocopy that chapter or something like that. But let's cash in a bit on some of the very good accounts which are given, and look out for more information and understanding about the part of the Muslim world, whether it's in minority or majority, where God has placed us.